You are now trapped. If you leave this room, we will see you leave. When you leave this room, you will carry with you... Oh, I drove her off. Oh, no, she's coming forward. Okay. We're going to pretend like this is church. Sit as far back as you possibly can so that you don't get called on to be in the nursery. Okay, she is going to leave early. Oh, okay. Congratulations. Okay, well, folks, this is session 362, titled "Without Death, We Cannot Mourn. Without Mourning, We Cannot Be Saved," on Mormonism's confrontation with its haunted, invisible body. Anything could happen today. You're right. Best, yeah, I definitely nominate this. Best title of the symposium. Please silence your cell phones, and please be respectful during the presentation. Please snore quietly. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope you will support the Mormon artists and vendors on the Handcrafters Row in the corridor. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time. Otherwise, I break your kneecaps. As a courtesy to the other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and go make a hefty donation to Sunstone. Thank you. You guys can't tell when I'm being funny, huh? I'm sorry. In this paper, Jacob will argue that Jesus' historical context provided a framework for what he meant about those who were the least of these within his community. But who the least of these are within a modern communities will differ according to the modern context and concerns. Jacob's going to argue for a specific interpretation of what this might mean for moral obligations regarding the least of these, and how Mormonism's natural universalism has become obscured by other concerns, hiding the least of these while in plain sight and making its body invisible to itself. Jacob's going to argue that a proper understanding of mourning as individual confrontation with death and the collective building of solidarity is the only long-term redemptive solution the moral obligations we have toward those in a community who qualify as the least of these, and that the collective salvation or damnation of a community hinges on how these are seen and responded to. And he's going to tell this to you in eighth grade language. It's going to be very interesting. Jacob Baker is a doctoral candidate in philosophy and religion and theology at Claremont Graduate University. He teaches ethics at Utah Valley University and is a freelance writer. And you may have seen him in costume in downtown Provo, where he is the masked Avenger. And now for the presentation.
All right, welcome. Thanks for attending. Wow. Just so you know, Carolyn Pearson and Julie Hanks are in Saltaire. And 10 Things Joseph Smith Can Tell Us About Donald Trump is in Panorama East, in case you've wandered into the wrong room. That's where those particular presentations are being had currently. If you're in the right room, thank you for coming and for listening. And thanks to Stephen for reading my abstract. My paper sounds somewhat like that abstract, but mostly not. It changed. Not too drastically, so you're still going to get the gist of what he talked about. But as is the case often with writing, it evolved and addresses some additional concerns. When you ask people who are socialist or socialist sympathizers, why socialism? You'll hear a variety of responses, but they're all related to the suffering caused from capitalist economic systems. I first discovered myself heading in this direction a few years ago, along with a lot of other white guys over the last 5 or 6 years. But part of my reasoning was different from most people who sympathize with or fully embrace socialism, at least the American and European varieties. And that was my religion. I had religious reasons for seeing the reasonableness of the core philosophical foundations of socialism. And this is unusual, though far from unheard of. In socialist circles, since historically religion has been, in Marx's famous words, the opiate for the masses, a deceptive balm for the suffering of the poor and the powerless that was in actuality a complicit oppressor that preys on the poor just as much as the factory owners and the aristocrats. The religious side of this only made it more complicated. I was a Mormon, not a liberal Protestant or a member of the New Catholic Left. Very few aspects of modern-day LDS Mormonism, with its optimistic embrace of capitalist ideology and practice, paralleled anything found under the umbrella of socialism. Some Mormons would point to a kind of socio-economic communism in the early days of the Mormon movement, but virtually no trace of that remains in Mormon theology or practice today. Further, I found socialism most compelling through the lens of what, ironically, might be called a traditionally Christian aspect of my Mormonism, and perhaps something that isn't even really Mormon at all, which is the New Testament. Mainstream Mormonism has a rather complicated, to put it lightly, relationship with the New Testament, one that is perhaps similar to common evangelical interpretations of Scripture. There, Christ is God supreme, a supernatural foreknowing agent who condescended to come into the world in order to save us from ourselves. This is what atonement is in modern Mormon theology, a mechanism whereby each one of us becomes reconciled to themselves through a third party, Christ. That is, we're split personalities, one personality being the person we are, sinful, and the other the personality we see we must become but do not have the will or the strength to do so. Sin is the failed negotiation between these two personalities, the failed merging of reality with ideal. And atonement is the bridge, the at-one-ment between these, creating a whole unitary individual with a single sinless identity in Christ. But this is a rather Greek interpretation of the New Testament themes in the sense that it focuses on the individual and individual salvation, a vision of how individuals enter the salvation process, or in the case of modern LDS Mormonism, families. The writers of the Gospels, however, had a much more communal understanding of salvation and how the entire community collectively would be redeemed, with the exception, of course, of the writer of the Gospel of John, who was clearly more influenced by Greek and Gnostic sources. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the chief theme is essentially the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, and collective preparation for it, its realization or understanding that is already among us. There will always be a debate about this. In John, however, the kingdom is rarely mentioned and its theology is much more individualized. Yet what I found compelling in the Gospels, in the first three Gospels in particular, was Jesus' lived religion, which was essentially that while no one would be getting out of this alive, certainly not Lazarus, who was consigned to die twice, we couldn't really live while others were dying. I was drawn to Jesus' single-minded focus on the least of these, whom he identified in Matthew 25 specifically as the hungry, the thirsty, the sick, the stranger, the poorly clothed, and the prisoner. Normally, we lump these all together and call them the poor and the marginalized. This, to me, was the only real fire religion had ever really started in my bones. I've often reflected on why this is so, but I don't entirely understand it. I've been relatively poor many times in my life, at this point more often than not, and I've always felt at least somewhat alienated from my religious community. But I could hardly be described as poor, marginalized, and excluded in the way the poor, marginalized, and excluded are presented in the Gospels. Perhaps my personal life experiences were enough to at least crack that door open and allow what today are more radical readings of the Gospels to appear compelling to me. Certainly, those readings push against the grain of more common interpretations. For example, we might say that, yes, the poor suffer from hunger, thirst, sickness, etc., to a greater extent than those who have their material needs provided for, and Jesus specifically mentions the poor in other passages. But perhaps this reading is not the only legitimate one. We've all felt hunger and thirst to varying degrees. We've all been strangers in some fashion in some places. Perhaps many of us could recall a time we could have been better clothed. Certainly, we've all experienced sickness. Maybe most of us haven't been physically imprisoned, but we could rightly say we've been prisoners in other ways, of our choices or habits or addictions or circumstances. Indeed, we could probably only have empathy for people experiencing these things because we've experienced at least versions of them ourselves. Could it be then that when Jesus refers to the least of these, he's in a certain way referring to every one of us? This is not an illegitimate reading in a limited pastoral sense. We all live in stratified and segregated societies, and if you even participate in conferences like these, chances are you are not living the life of the destitute that Jesus turned to in radical compassion. But isn't Jesus for everyone? Isn't he at least potentially the personal savior of every human being, or at least every Christian? This would, of course, be the reading that is most compelling to those who do not fit the description of those whom Jesus walked among and healed. Because the New Testament Jesus either doesn't really see you, because whatever your other problems are, you are not being trampled on and killed by powerful people. And if he does speak to you, it's in angry condemnation and barely concealed disgust, because you are one of the powerful people doing the trampling and the killing. How then to have a Jesus you can call your own? To have that kind of Jesus, you would turn to the Gospel of John, the gospel so many of us who live in relatively privileged and removed circumstances have been historically drawn to. The prologue to the gospel calls Jesus the Word, or in Greek, Logos. In ancient Greek philosophy, Logos was the cosmic principle of reason. Jesus, then, more Christ than Jesus in this gospel, is presented as reason incarnate, the way, the truth, and the life for all people universally. Christ is divine, no question. How he is divine is complicated, but he is still a God in some fashion in this gospel. In the first three gospels, Jesus goes on at length about the kingdom of God, whereas in John, he speaks of his own divinity. Most importantly for our purposes here, the Gospel of John is the only gospel that so explicitly invites us to have a personal relationship with God through Christ. In fact, it is only through Christ, as individually divine or as a member of a Godhead, that one can speak of the possibility and importance of being related to the divine at all. In a somewhat analogous sense that Paul tells us Christ emptied himself of divinity in order to become incarnate and walk among us, the Gospel of John, Christ empties himself of Jesus and becomes a being that is accessible to all. Of course, among believers, the synoptic gospels are not so opposed to the Gospel of John. John is merely an additional take, enhancing what we know about Jesus as the Christ. And yet the Jesus in John is inarguably different from the Jesus in the synoptics, the first three gospels. And those differences surely constitute some of the primary reasons more socioeconomically privileged persons and communities understandably turn to John, or at least the theological framework that John popularized, more than to the other three gospels. In fact, this framework of personal relationship with the divine, of Jesus as divine cosmic reason incarnate that all people can understand and that has the power to save everyone individually, is often read back into the other three gospels and becomes the lens through which they are understood. Parables become metaphors for one's individual spiritual journey back to God, etc. Yet the Jesus in the synoptic gospels took sides, and not merely in a cosmic good versus evil sense. More than condemning the rich, he condemned political and social power. He was single-mindedly focused on a kingdom of reversal, and therefore a kingdom of divine weakness. First is last, out is in, the lost are found. Weak forces like forgiveness and peace rule this kingdom, not strong forces like dogma and authority. The kingdom of God reigned wherever the most vulnerable find favor and safety, where the one is preferred to the 99, where enemies are loved and family is despised. because we find it impossible to plug ourselves into the wider kingdom community due to our single-minded attachment to family, and where the powerful are put on the defensive. Of course, that makes all of this, what makes all of this so powerful, the reason why this narrative has endured the oppositional powers of institutions and privileged societies, is because Jesus didn't just teach the kingdom of divine reversal, he lived it. He didn't just declare to his friends the moral wrongness of Roman and Jewish power, he went to the ground zero of their wrongness, the powerless people they had created, and did what he could to feed, heal, and empower them. He went to the sick, despairing, and outcast and showed them the seats in the pews and the beds in the homes that God had sent him to build. And so even before he gave his life for this cause, he showed that a kingdom built by divine weakness can only be realized through personal sacrifice. Of course, most of us might feel ourselves to be living on the margins in some fashion, and therefore, to a certain degree, we feel we identify with the least of these. Marginalization can be understood as multidimensional in this sense. I may be white but also poor, rich but also black, financially comfortable but also gay. But the picture of marginalization and exile in the Gospels is much stronger and more clearly demarcated than this. There, it is explicitly about those who are crushed by the power of institutions and the people that hold power within institutions. Institutions as the seats of consolidated and concentrated power have always been the problem. They have the power to both bless and curse, create and destroy. Naturally, we want to focus on their creative and life-giving functions because we are their beneficiaries. We could preface this with an insight from Michel Foucault, the French philosopher. Quote, "Truth isn't the reward of free spirits, the child of protracted solitude, nor the privilege of those who have succeeded in liberating themselves. The relationship that modern Mormons, for example, have with truth is straightforwardly platonic in this way, and actually reflects some of the cosmo-theological framing in the Gospel of John. The masses are imprisoned in a dark cave, mistaking the shadows dancing on the wall for the real world. What they need is an enlightened one. He, almost always a he, of course, who has been to the surface and has seen the whole truth. And there it sits, out in the open, simply waiting to be gazed upon and accepted. But upon re-entering the cave with this earth-shattering revelation, he finds that most of the masses reject the real light. They cannot conceive of a reality that is not the one before their eyes. Except, of course, for a chosen few who follow the enlightened one out of the cave and into the truth. Now they will dedicate the rest of their lives to preaching the one truth to those who sit in darkness, pulling as many out as they can, providing a safe space for these refugees of half-truths and lies." Foucault rejects this account of truth, where truth is simply hidden, waiting to be discovered and utilized. Those who successfully locate it are then empowered to do things in its name. Instead, he asks, what if it is power that produces the truths that govern our lives and not the other way around? And instead of looking where power is concentrated, trying to parse the good versus the bad that it enacts, we should be looking to who and what power subjugates, twists, and crushes. Individuals are both the vehicles of and the targets of power, and they are both vehicle and target through the institutions that produce them. Power isn't merely this thing that, like a similar conception of truth, certain people learn to take for themselves. It is given to them and circulates through institutions. Where they sit within the vast cogs of these institutions, schools, governments, churches, businesses, practically any kind of substantial organization, Sunstone, even families to a certain extent, will determine what kind of power they have and are pressed into service by. Our moral and even religious obligation is to deconstruct power at the contact points of its subjugative character, at the points where it hurts and exhausts those who become its malicious targets or who are cast aside by its ordered procedures. We do not, on the other hand, have a moral obligation to praise institutions for the good that they might do, to focus on how certain individuals may have been helped in certain ways because the institution had the focused resources to do so. If it is an institution, subjugation is occurring, period. Marginalization is occurring. Exile is occurring. People are being forgotten. Worldviews and attitudes that hurt or leave out individuals and groups are becoming entrenched and organizationally expressed. Institutions will do what they do. If they only exist to hear their own praise, then they doubly deserve to pass into history. Our moral obligation to make visible the contact points of subjugation and ghettoization does not include producing a balance sheet of pros and cons for the sake of accuracy. That institutions can also advance the good in various ways does not remove our obligation to deconstruct their power in the name of that which becomes invisible in their wake. And to hold up a putative good as a defense against their subjugation is an attempt to distract us away from the heart of that which remains to be critiqued. In fact, an inordinate attention to one form of oppression pushes other forms of oppression into even deeper obscurity, as institutions benefit from the social capital that comes with being seen as purveyors of justice. And this is not to simply be against institutions per se, as if we could ever be entirely free of institutions. Jacques Derrida, the great deconstructor of texts, and by extension, institutions, insisted that deconstruction was not an attempt to destroy institutions, but to open them to their own future. And a persistent problem with institutions is that they cannot break with their pasts while inaugurating something genuinely new. That is, the inauguration of an institution is full of risk and novelty. This generates passion and purpose. But institutions quickly ossify and become that which they attempted to break away from in the first place. They become dogmatic and often held captive to authoritarians or charismatics. To deconstruct them is to point to what has been missed or cast aside or stepped on in the process of expansion and ossification. Deconstruction is the tension inherent in the preservation of what has been given and the heterogeneity of something new, of that which breaks with the institution's self-aggrandizement. Which is one reason why leaders of institutions can be so problematic and dangerous, especially where they are also founders of the institution that made them powerful. Rarely can they sit this tension on their shoulders to preserve what might be worth preserving while constantly inaugurating the breaks with the past that are necessary in order for the institution to not become less of a concentrated center of power that hurts and marginalizes. It's unlikely that any institution can rid itself entirely of its capacity to marginalize, so this is always an unfinished project. As products of the institution, but also as the primary vehicles of its power, leaders become the living instantiation of institutions. The more powerful the institution becomes, the more powerful the leader becomes. And this makes it much more difficult for the leader to see what is being missed or who is being hurt. He or she has the most vested interest in ignoring the ways in which the institution must break apart in order to preserve that which is worth preserving. If you want to look to a leadership model that doesn't come undone through the corrupting power of institutions, you can look, somewhat stereotypically, to Jesus. So here we'll circle back to him for a moment. The founder of a movement, but not an institution, Jesus created no formal organization, and therefore his truths were not merely productions of economic or political organizations. Even in the most questionable version of his life, which unironically is the Gospel of John once again, where he insisted that he was the truth, his transgressive style of teaching and the events of his life prevented his institutionalization until well after his death. His movement formed around his Galilean deconstruction of power in withering religious and political criticisms of Jewish and Roman leaders, as well as his novel reformulation of personal spirituality that had become so inwardly self-focused. Of course, the fact that he was killed for his criticism certainly did more than anything else to immortalize the truths that he preached. But there's an important lesson even here, which is that a leader is only as vital as his or her commitment to personal sacrifice. Whether it is stepping down at the right time or recognizing that truths cannot be commodified and sold at market and still remain something recognizable as a human value. The more privileged you are by virtue of the institution that created you, the greater the personal sacrifice that must be made on behalf of its future. There is a sense in which Nietzsche's madman proclaiming the death of God is not for Christianity alone. It is for any God who rules over anyone through the institutions that give us the truths that govern our lives. Nietzsche, of course, believed that God's death was good because it wiped out a toxic old world that had imposed meaning and value on everything in the universe. Now, he thought, we can make our own meanings and value what we chose, free from priestly imposition. To deconstruct our institutions and their gods is merely, though very seriously, to insist that things as they really are, really might be otherwise than instituted. But how to do this? Derrida suggests that we look for the tensions and contradictions within our own traditions. That is, you cannot effectively deconstruct something from the outside. You can only point to a tension or paradox that's going on within the text or tradition itself, which of course requires an intimate familiarity with the text or tradition or institution. For example, the Proclamation on the Family is, on its surface and in its ecclesiastical employment, a document that elevates and sacralizes the nuclear family. However, the specter of polygamy not only haunts Mormon history, it is also entangled in the Mormon present in various ways. Even the notion that marriage is eternal cannot be divorced from its polygamous origin or the way in which there is a polygamous aspect of eternal marriage that is hidden within all current Mormon temple marriages. This, then, would be a tension or a contradiction within the proclamation, not because it is explicitly there, but because it is latent, hidden, and must be revealed. And what would be the purpose of heightening that tension? Because it shows that there is no clean gloss on what family means in the Mormon tradition, and therefore the idea of family can be reconfigured, particularly in order to fit the reality of a multiplicity of family configurations that already exist in the world. And to the extent that we provincially ignore the realities that contend to be part of the phenomenon that is families, our hold on this idea is weakened, and ultimately our defense of it as a primary value is diminished because its universality is diminished. Yet our ability to deconstruct texts and institutions, even being able to see that this might be a good thing to do, is itself a privileged construct, one that is accessible virtually only to people with a particular kind of education, though it could be argued that all education is a form of deconstruction or the art of deconstruction. So while the act of deconstruction is good and still necessary, at minimum as a form of resistance against one's own insulation from others through layers of privilege and power, I'm going to suggest that there's something a bit more egalitarian, something that is more common to the human experience as a whole, and that's the act of mourning. The philosopher and cultural critic Judith Butler asks an interesting question in this regard. What, she asks, makes for a grievable life? On the one hand, all of us have lost someone or will lose someone. Loss in this sense makes a we of all of us. And loss and vulnerability seem to be possible largely because we are socially constituted bodies, attached to others, at risk of losing attachments, exposed to violence in varying degrees from these attachments, etc. Most people, says Butler, think that grief is private. I would also add that this notion of private grief is probably more prevalent in Euro-American communities. But grief can and should furnish a sense of political community, and does this by making visible the relations among various people and the different configurations of ethical responsibility we have. Mourning allows us to encounter one another and, possibly, hopefully, be undone by one another. If we are not undone by another's suffering, we are missing something, she insists. Quote, "For if I am confounded by you, then you are already of me, and I am nowhere without you. I cannot muster the we, except by finding the way in which I am tied to you, by trying to translate but finding that my own language must break up and yield if I am to know you. You are what I gain through this disorientation and loss. This is how the human comes into being again and again, and that which we have yet to know." Close quote. Who we are allowed to mourn and grieve in a society tells us a lot about what we understand about being human. The human is fundamentally mournable. It is life that merits consideration, respect, and a kind of collectivized consensus of value. Mournable bodies that die are celebrated through acts of public mourning. More importantly, mournable bodies are inherently mournable while still living. The consideration and respect extended at death by the still living begins with bodies that can and are respected, considered, and valued while still alive or still present. The crucial question here, though, is who is mournable and who is unmournable? Who is publicly grievable is possibly the fundamental question that pervades all politics. Bodies are fundamentally unmournable not when they die, but while they live. For an inherently unmournable body to become a mournable body in society, he or she must transcend their unmournability and become a part of the public consciousness to an extraordinary degree. Think Martin Luther King as an example here. Becoming serviceable or useful to the majority population in such a way that they merit respect, consideration, and value disproportionate to those who remain in obscurity. Even here, though, their value is one of utility, not full humanity. The least of these, then, in this sense, are those whom are not mourned in death and who are fundamentally unmournable in life. And they are unmournable because they are invisible. They are understood in the base cognitive sense. They are poor or not heteronormative or not white. And this is easily understood, but they are not seen in their unity. That which marginalizes them detracts from their full humanity. It is not constitutive of their humanity, and therefore they are, in this sense, not fully visible. And if not fully visible, not mournable. Someone I know distantly, as an example, suddenly lost a loved one. This person was and remains a very difficult personality for me. I virtually always disagreed with him and still generally find him to be abrasive, passive-aggressive, and narcissistic. The virtual distance between us made it easier to think what I wanted about him. And I am sure that there were many things I believed that had no factual basis. So I conveniently despised him from a distance, and he would conveniently, with remarkable precision, live up to my judgments about him. Yet, news of his family's loss erased, at least for a time, years of compounded antagonism. It's humbling the effect another suffering can have on us. Animosity and invincibility fall away upon being confronted with their loss. The parts of our hearts that have been broken by our own sufferings reach out to the broken heart of another. And sometimes openly, sometimes silently and invisibly, we weep together. We feel in those moments, as Joseph Smith was reported to have once said, the desire to take their cares and sorrows upon our own shoulders and cast their supposed sins behind our backs. But the mere fact of suffering doesn't always have this effect. When our hearts soften toward others because of their grief or loss, we can scarcely believe this experience is not inevitable, but it is not. There is nothing guaranteeing our empathy, compassion, or mercy. Sometimes the conditions for these virtues align themselves in such a way we feel compelled against our natural, unthinking wills to put aside our antagonisms. Other times, no matter the favorable conditions for forgiveness and compassion, we choose to bury these virtues and reserve them for more worthy persons, often persons who can prop up our gods and make us feel better about ourselves. At times, we feel irresistibly drawn to compassion. At other times, confrontation with suffering presents itself as a choice, and we often choose hardness. The work of mourning is a knife that efficiently cuts away the outer protective shells we have carefully built to keep others away, obscuring our view of one another. But what really changes here? Traits we formerly found so difficult or impossible have not magically disappeared. Instead, our eyes have changed, if only briefly. These things have faded into the posturing background noise, where they were almost always most at home, of a lived life. Now we see the enemy or the stranger truly, and as we mourn with them, they become a person we can actually love. Mourning elides space-time in this way and takes what would have been years, if ever, of bitterly hard work and condenses it into a shared moment where time stands still and we are left with only each other. Mourning makes us real to one another, and in the case of the enemy, real for the first time. It counteracts the usual human work of cutting out caricatures of people to better serve our needs. Such caricatures are easier to use, dismiss, or even kill than real persons. Only in suffering, as Butler suggests, are we really ever all together. The problem is that each community hides certain members of the community from itself, and in their hidden state, they become unmournable at the level of community. That they are hidden in plain sight makes their hiddenness that much more effective. What is being hidden? The ways in which they suffer directly from the institutions as institutions of which they are members. In other words, institutional suffering is hidden away. The institution and those who defend it, purposely, though usually not consciously, blind themselves to suffering that the institution itself causes. Those who have been pushed to the margins and exiled to the borders are not mournable. Their bodies are not publicly grievable because their particular suffering, for all intents and purposes, does not exist. And the method by which the institution blinds itself to its own damage is by seamlessly conflating human mortality with institutional political structures. Everyone knows the feeling of his or her proverbial house being on fire, and most people feel like they're having to put out fires all the time. Difficult marriages, problems with children, financial struggles, others' harsh judgments, illness, death, and on and on. That's just being human. So when the privileged hear that the proverbial houses of marginalized communities are on fire, while their houses are comparatively unaffected, they don't buy it, even if they can actually see that those other fires are likely worse or have been burning for a long, long time. Whether those fires are worse or not, they have their hands full with their own problems. A recent article in The Guardian illustrates this well. Quote, "The most dangerous phrase in the English language is, be a man," close quote. This is the opening line for a piece that describes toxic masculinity, or how most boys are taught to suppress emotion, ruthlessly fight for success in sex, reject sympathy and empathy, etc. The result is violence, depression, and anxiety. We could say that the houses of these boys are just as much on fire as anyone else's house. They are haunted into adulthood by impossible and poisonous expectations about what it means to be men, expectations which maliciously shape every facet of their lives. Yet we also have to note that these are boys. The majority of them are probably white boys. Many come from affluent homes. In many cases, then, they are the epitome of privilege, despite the fact that they all have problems, sometimes very big problems. But having problems, comparing whose problems are worse, is not what is being communicated in asserting that minority communities and individuals experience institutional suffering. When we say that the marginalized are unmournable, we are not talking about having problems or even exceptional experiences of intense and prolonged suffering. We are all valuable because we are all human, and all humans have human problems. Some in minority communities have it worse than I do, but surely with my array of difficulties and struggles, I have more than enough on my plate to deal with, and in some ways, I probably do have it worse than many others. So to say their lives matter is to assert that my problems don't matter, and therefore to assert that my house can't really burn. Thus, my life doesn't matter. No other lives matter, just marginalized lives. They're the only ones that really matter because they're the only ones with real problems. But I have problems too. They clearly just want special attention and advantage, all of it unmerited. And we're all exactly the same because in the end we all die, and God loves everyone equally. But our shared mortality is not what is being asserted when we say that the least of these really do exist, that not all lives are equally valued and equally mournable, that we are not all, at one time or another, one of the least of these just because we suffer too. This phrase is addressing not so much the people who constitute it, but the powers that put them there in the first place, echoing John Dominic Crossan's famous emphasis on not why Jesus had to die in some cosmic sense, but why he was killed and who killed him. The answer to that question constitutes the essence of the deconstructive mindset, the willful intention to see what is hidden, what is in tension with an institution or tradition, what is being left out and left behind, what is being pushed to the edges, out of sight, so the institution may continue on as it has before. And that mindset is often not possible where we cannot or will not mourn others in their full mournability, not only in death but in life as well. To mourn the living is to be open to the ways in which they are constantly dying, to that which is hastening their final death, to see them on the same horizon as one's own impending death. It is a willingness too often imposed on us to have our hearts broken on their behalf, to accept them fully into the body of the community by giving up the role of gatekeeper and defender of the community. The spirit of the movement and worldview that Jesus so fully committed himself to, that he lost his life for, is one of incorporation, of unplugging from everything, including one's own family, in order to become a part of a greater whole, to make of the entire community a family, not to exist within the community as individual families, weakly and frailly tied to one another through dogma and tradition. Thank you.
All right. Whoa, that took longer than I thought it would. We've got about 20 minutes. The time just flew by, Jacob. Just flew. Yeah,
it did for me. That's for sure.
So we've got about 20 minutes to ask cogent and deeply reflective questions of this cogent and deeply reflective essay. And Jacob has promised that he will not use any four-letter words in his replies.
Just 14, 16-letter words.
Right, yeah, at a minimum. Do we have any questions at the moment? Yes.
Okay. So this is kind of a hodgepodge of several things. That's why when I read over it, it's a little, at least to my ears, a little bit disjointed. And the transitions don't really flow. I mean, you know, the common things that you throw at yourself as a writer, right? So it's kind of a mix of things. Part of it is just kind of a political reorientation for me over the last few years. Seeing things a little bit differently politically than I had before. Also around that same time, I began to get an interest in mourning as a concept, like a philosophical concept. And often people get interested in the philosophical concepts because they don't have a whole lot of experience with the actual practice of it. Because I was in a conversation with a friend and I was like, you know, no one close to me has ever died. And this was like 3 years ago. And they're like, really? He's like, this friend, like, mother had died when he was five, and all of his grandparents were dead, and all of his aunts and uncles had passed on in really mysteriously crazy ways. And he's like, yeah, I've been to so many funerals. And I was like, yeah, I've been to a few funerals, but not really of anyone that I had known for the most part. And I realized that I got to think, I was like, have I ever really mourned for anyone? I've mourned for different things, in a sense, like the passage of time, right? Certain phases of your life that pass and then they never come again. I've even mourned for myself in a way when you look at different phases of your life and you're a person now that you weren't like 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And in a sense, that person had died in a rather violent way. And so you kind of mourn who that person was to kind of move on with your life. So I felt I had kind of done that on a personal level, but I hadn't really grieved with someone per se. And I just got reading on the subject. I read a lot of Freud. Freud talked a lot about mourning, mostly in wrong ways, I think. But that's typical of Freud. Freud's really good at getting you thinking about things, but his answers are not so good. But that's why he's important, is because like, oh, wow, that's fantastically wrong. But thanks for pointing me in that direction. You know, that's Freud. Paul Ricoeur has stuff on mourning. Judith Butler, obviously. She has a great piece called Violent Mourning in Politics. That's in one of her anthologies. That's fantastic. And it's all you really need to read about Freud in that piece, ultimately. She breaks it down really well. And so I wrote a few blog posts about mourning, and some of those were incorporated into the paper in I added some things, took out some things. But the institutional suffering thing, the problems with institutions, that's somewhat recent. And I started looking into that kind of as a writer because I started seeing commonalities among organizations and institutions. Like, it wasn't just the church. There were things going on, Sunstone, Mormon Stories, my own school, at the level of the country, at the level of the state, the level of the city, right? And there were commonalities that were kind of associated with institutions. And this is something that Foucault had picked up, and what he partly became famous for over the course of his career was his deconstruction of institutions and what institutions do to and for us, essentially. And so that got me started thinking about that as well. It's pretty basic if you're into French philosophy, which I haven't been as much. And so, like, people that are really into it was like, oh, yeah, Foucault and institutions. That's, like, so, like, freshman year or whatever. And I was like, not for me. This sounds great. This is kind of like what I've been thinking about with politics and mourning and things of that nature. So it was just a bundle of things together. It wasn't any one particular singular event that got me off on this track. The paper itself, the framework for it, I had already there for a while. And then, like, over, like, the last 2 days, I finally just wrote it all out, which is also probably accounts for some of its disjointedness as well. Just kind of a marathon writing session to finish it. But yeah, a lot of the subjects there have been percolating for a long time and been written about in different forms.
So, Jacob, let me ask you a question. So the basic idea here is that institutions always marginalize people. Institutions get rigid and start pursuing their own interests. And the thing that seems to deconstruct them seems to be mourning. Mourning is a deconstructive tool, but it also seems like you're saying that a lot of work gets done in mourning in an institution, and that at every point an institution should invite mourning, yeah, despite its deconstruction. Have you seen examples of that happening in any institutions recently?
Are you thinking of something specific?
I'm not.
Okay. You're trying to get me to remember?
I'm looking for real wisdom here.
I think mourning kind of helps an institution, at least for certain people, like, that are involved in that process, kind of reset itself to a certain degree, because it kind of reveals things. So my example that I have about this person that was not a friend of mine that I really didn't like, and they lost someone in their life, and they went on social media and they're like, I'm just totally broken. And, like, no one comes in and starts arguing, obviously, with that person. I mean, in theory, especially considering the last election, there might be hordes of people that would be inclined to do that. But this is before the election, so maybe that's why it's different. I don't know. But everyone on there, enemies, friends, distant acquaintances, went on there to offer their condolences. And it was just this huge moment, right? That they're all coming together around this person's suffering because they had lost, in this case, I think it was like a niece or a nephew or something. But probably even more so if it had been like a child or whatever. And you'll see this, like, portrayed in cinema too, right? You'll see these two people that are enemies and one of their children dies and then they're just like hugging at a funeral. And nothing else could have possibly caused that to happen. Right? There's no debate or civil dialogue or incentive of any kind that could have caused the feeling and emotion to exist between them in that way. It required some sort of catastrophic personal event to do that. And that's part of the problem, is that mourning is not an entirely intentional practice. I mean, it could be much more intentional. And I think that's, like, another paper in and of itself kind of responding to this. But what happened in this particular incident with this particular person was just an event that happened. It wasn't something that anybody could have anticipated, and its result was also unanticipated. Because, again, like I say in the paper, that feeling of having, like, of your heart reaching out to another one who is suffering, who was formerly your enemy, is not some sort of inevitable human phenomenon. right? That could, like, that's actually, like, not happened with me in other cases where someone has something difficult happen to them in their lives, and I was, for the most part, indifferent. Well, that's too bad. Now, granted, it's in the same way. It wasn't a family member. It was just somebody I knew. But for whatever reason that I don't completely understand, my heart was not broken for that person in the same way. And who knows why that's the case, right? Of course, part of what we're trying to do in writing and talking and coming to events like this and things of that nature is figuring out what our stories are. Our stories are essentially our beliefs and vice versa. And the more we understand our stories, I think the better we're enabled to go through this process with people. And the less we understand our stories is the more we kind of project a caricature of ourselves that's unable to relate to others in this way. So kind of to get back to, I can't think of anything offhand where this has happened on sort of a mass scale. And that probably should be thought about, because other than that, it's a lot of this is just kind of theoretical. Even if some of it's personal, it's still theoretical at the general level. But I think that institutions can only be benefited by taking mourning more seriously in that way. It does the kind of work of keeping the institution together and inaugurating at least potentially a new future for an institution when this happens, when people come together around some sort of a shared grief. And the other prong of that, of course, is when you take mourning more seriously, you take the mournable more seriously. Like, you start becoming more aware and self-conscious of what it means not just to mourn, but who to mourn, right? Because part of the burden of the paper is to say that those bodies that are unmournable and ungrievable, that are invisible, they're not being served in the community. They're part of Mormonism's, in this case Mormonism, right? But in practically any community, they haunt the body of Mormonism because they're not addressed in the way that they're supposed to be. They don't live in the way they're supposed to live. They don't die how they could otherwise be allowed to die, right? And it's principally because they're invisible to us in particular ways. They're right in front of us, but institutionally, we're blind to them. And because of that, there's a lot of suffering that happens at an institutional level that would not otherwise need to be the case. And so like Derrida said, this is like an unfinished project, right? There's always something you're missing in the text or in the institution or in the tradition. And that which is missing is not just missing, it's hurting, right? It's on the borders in some form of marginalization and exile and has to be recognized and revealed. Jack. Yeah, I mean, Butler, the way Butler talks, and part of the problem with Freud is that Freud thinks mourning only happens when someone dies, right? But the way Butler talks, the way Ricoeur, I think, talks about this, I think Derrida even addresses mourning in relation to hospitality in a certain place, but I can't recall the reference, is that mourning is not a thing that you do after death. It's a thing you're constantly doing because there's several ways in which you're constantly having to mourn the passage of time, because the passage of time is a killer, right? It's killing things left and right in your life. Most catastrophically, it's people, of course, when a person dies, but it's the choices that you make. It's the stages of life you go through and that can never return. It's memories that haunt you, et cetera, right? And so Butler says we're in a position to constantly be in a kind of mourning. It's not like the kind of widow's mourning where you're like, you know, wearing the veil for the rest of your life and just completely lost all hope altogether, that would be the exact opposite effect of what she thinks mourning does for us. Mourning gives us hope because it reveals one another. It reveals both ourselves to ourselves and other people to us. I think she would say in particular, like anticipatory mourning, when you become aware of the fact that you're probably already doing it, right? You see, like in your case, your dad in a way that like your eyes see him, see things about him that they've never been seen before. And you consider him in a particular kind of light that you weren't able to consider and that most people can only consider post-mortem, right, after they pass on. And so there's a particular kind of way that you mourn with him as if he's already gone, right? And yet he's still there. But he's mourning too, right? He's mourning his own death. He's mourning all the possibilities that will not be. And that's whether he dies prematurely or dies at a good old age, right? That's going to happen either way. And if you're in a position to anticipate that, it's both terrible because like Thomas Ligotti likes to say, he's like, the worst thing that ever happened to the human race is they got consciousness. They became aware that they're going to die. Whereas before, they could live in bliss that all they could do is eat and reproduce. And they couldn't engage in that kind of mourning, right? But now they become aware that the horizon of death awaits everyone, right? So if well before they die, they're going to watch loved ones die. And it's really kind of with death being on the horizon that we're really supposed to relate to each other, Butler says. Like, how do we become real to each other? It's because we're always already broken. No matter how healthy we feel, we're broken by the fact that we're all going to die and everyone around us is going to perish too. And we're going to be unfortunate witnesses of many of them perishing before we are. But rather than that be something that is utterly hopeless, instead it becomes the possibility of seeing each other for who we really are. If we really mutually see each other's deaths on the horizon. Right? So for Butler and for a lot of philosophers, we don't consider our own death enough. Mostly we use strategies to distract ourselves from the fact that we're going to pass on. Whether that's religion or entertainment or whatever, right? We're constantly just trying to distract ourselves. But the problem with that is we might be successful at distracting ourselves from our own deaths, but distracting ourselves from the deaths of others is much more difficult, right? It's harder to put the veil over our own eyes when it comes to other people's realities in that sense. But at the same time, we kind of do that with certain bodies within the community, essentially. We kind of make them invisible in certain ways so that the institution that we're all members of, the thing that makes us all a body in the first place, can continue on as it's always continued, without the need to have to change, to break apart in certain ways, to redo or revise things, right? And so for Butler, to be more collectively aware of the fact that we're already all in mourning, and when we're aware of that, we can enrich the process in particular kinds of ways. And we become more patient with one another. We become more forgiving. We give people more latitude, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, we just become better people with one another, et cetera. And that's one of the reasons why she says, I have to be confounded by you, and you have to be confounded by me, right? We have to break one another in those particular ways, or otherwise we're just dealing with caricatures of each other. Particularly like egocentric and narcissistic ways in which we project ourselves onto the world so that we can constantly prove over and over again that we're lovable, right? That you shouldn't abandon us. Let me give you reasons why. But instead of giving the reasons, all we have to be able to do is see each other for who we really are. And Butler's argument here is that is really only done in the mourning process, in which we're grieving one another's deaths, either because they're dying before our eyes, or they will die someday, or some aspect of their lives is being killed. Right? And so that's why so many people have come to the conclusion that it's only in suffering that we really see each other, and it's only in suffering that we're really together. Because when we're not suffering, we're just distracting. We're just using that as a coping mechanism. So
that's very interesting. It also brings me back to the the base of the baptismal covenant is to mourn with those who mourn. It's as if Elma totally agrees with you that it's only in mourning that a community is really as vibrant as it needs to be in order to be Zion. Grief and mourning is at the bottom of that. We've reached the end of our time. Thanks to all the pure in heart who have attended today. May you go forth in mourning.